Good morning, everyone. We have a number of hearings to have today, and we intend to pretty much go in the order that's on the agenda. I want to announce that House Bill 3097 will not be receiving a complete hearing today. That will be a tap-in, tap-out hearing. That's not quite ready to go yet. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3063 and have the staff read the summary. And welcome, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3063 exempts equine facilities from state structural code, and it exempts equine facilities from engineering definition of significant structures. There is a dash one amendment that removes the language that allows for the schooling shows for this, those to be exempt. So that's it.
And we have testimony coming around. Good morning, Representative Crummell.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I do appreciate it. House Bill 3063 was introduced by me at the request of the Rudigers. The Rudigers live in my district, House District 26. Oh, by the way, I guess I better stop for just a second. I'm Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, now that I've got for the record.
Okay.
And I'm also Jerry Crummell, not for the record. Madam Chair, this bill was brought to the idea was brought to me by the Rudigers. We have some problems in the counties from a standpoint of equine facilities and the definitions. And so, what this bill does is that it will basically clear up those definitions. We have a number of situations, and I'll let the Rudigers actually go into more detail with regards to the need for the bill and that sort of thing. But they did bring it to my attention, and I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, I do appreciate your having a hearing today, and would also appreciate seeing the bill move. So with that, I'm going to stop and let the Rudigers go to your mind. I know you have a busy schedule, and I want to keep my remarks to a minimum.
Thank you, Representative Crummell, and you were extremely conscientious in bringing this to our attention. Please continue.
Madam Chair, thank you for hearing our testimony today. Representatives, thank you very much. We respect this committee's time, and we'll keep things brief also. My name is Dan Rudiger. Next to me is my wife, Gina. And we have a property in Sherwood, actually non-incorporated Sherwood, which is more like Wilsonville in District 26 in our representative's district. We have recently put together a small-scale equestrian facility. In doing so, we've run into numerous problems with the county and the state law and the codes associated with this. I'm going to basically paraphrase what we have written down. I've provided a copy of our reasoning and our testimony here for you, and I'll simply paraphrase what the problem is and what the bill, how it helps the, how the bill 3063 helps cover the problem. Currently, there is a problem in the equestrian community. The vast majority, and I don't have a number, but it's probably 98-99% of equestrian facilities are actually operating illegally in the state of Oregon. They are not in compliance with the current interpretation of the building code. The code has been interpreted to require that all horse boarding and training operations, regardless of size, so whether it's bringing one horse in or bringing 10 horses in, regardless of size, has to comply with commercial standards for public buildings, equal to that of a bank and or a Home Depot store. This poses numerous problems for the equestrian community in Oregon. First of all, the cost of compliance for barn owners typically exceeds the structure involved. For example, the cost of complying with the code, specifically in our discussions with Clackamas Counties, who we've worked with, would be approximately $300,000, which could be, in some cases, four times the actual structure of the building. Many of these buildings would be valued at $50,000, perhaps $100,000, and the cost to comply with that is typically three times that. If the county were to enforce the code, there would be many people that would have to shut down their barns, most people that would have to shut down their barns, and thus thousands of horses would be left without a home in the state of Oregon. Number two, county could be held negligent and liable for lack of enforcement of these codes. They are aware of these codes, and they are trying to determine how they enforce these codes, which is extremely difficult for the county. They've acknowledged through investigations and complaints that some farms are out of compliance of this. They've allowed this to continue, and they've basically shut the file. They've shut the case. They have a problem with enforcing this code. Exhibit A, as you can see, this is an internal memo from the county called Prioritization of Community Environments Violations. You can see that because of the resources and constraints that the county has to enforce this, they've indicated, at least Clackamas County has, what to enforce and what not to enforce. You can see levels 1 through 4 on page, the first page, simply state that if a barn is out of compliance for over 10 years, we're going to look the other way. On page 3, I've outlined, page 4, I've outlined, you can see just in highlighted there, representatives, indoor riding, and net and chair, indoor riding arena, boarding facility, with greater than 20 occupants will be enforced. The code states nothing about 20 occupants, 10 occupants, 5 occupants, or 1 occupant. They've chosen this as an interpretation of the code, not simply stated by the code. Last page on this document, what they will not enforce, they said, indoor riding arenas with less than 20 occupants. Lastly, it says horse boarding facilities without indoor riding arenas will also not be enforced, which implies to me that horse boarding facilities with indoor riding arenas will be enforced. You can see that there's a problem with the code, and there's no rhyme or reason behind how they choose this. Washington County has the rule of 10. So each county is choosing what to enforce and what not to enforce. In our opinion, this provides the county with a great deal of negligence and liability. Lastly, we all possess, or most conscientious and responsible barn owners possess, insurance. In doing so, this insurance could be denied if there were a claim or a catastrophe or a crime occurring in the barn because the barns are out of compliance with county code. House Bill 3063 corrects this problem very narrowly and very specifically. It states that facilities with less than 10 people in the buildings should be considered agricultural exempt. It's simply stating that we're using this for animal husbandry, just like the law indicates, but only for 10 people in this barn. What we would like the committee to be able to pass, with the exception, again, we have an exception on there of the number one, I think it was called, we'd like the committee to be able to pass barns with 10 or less people in them be considered agricultural exempt and therefore not have to comply with these codes. These small-scale facilities described are for the uses of animal husbandry. We do not suggest that they be used for schooling shows or events or seminars. We would just like simply to have the horses boarded there. I thank you for your time, and if we have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dan. That's a very complete presentation. I think that really clarifies the issue for us. Any questions?
I have one.
Representative Shoffler.
I imagine that out of all the barns in Oregon, that a huge percentage of them probably predate the building code, so they'd be under conditional use or grandfather anyway. I mean, if Clackamas County, where I live, ran around trying to enforce building codes in every building in the county, they'd never run out of work. But what brought you here in the first place? Did the county try to enforce a code that you felt was just economically exorbitant and prohibitive? Is that what inspired you?
Madam Chair and Representative Shuffler, I can explain that. The county did, in fact, have discussions with us regarding our facility that we've recently put together, and they have there's two barns right near us. The barn up the street and the barn down the way were recently built, and they were out of compliance, and the county closed their file on those barns. The county decided not to enforce. Now, right now, the county has all our information, and they're deciding on whether or not to enforce this. We are trying to come here so that the county has strict guidelines of what to enforce and what not to enforce, so it's not arbitrary, because what's happening is it's arbitrary with people.
Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if I might also point out the Dash 1 amendments.
Yes.
Inadvertently, the term schooling shows was included in the original bill, so the Dash 1 amendments on line 29 would basically remove that, so that there's not a confusion. And I would also leave it to you, Madam Chair, to determine whether this is something that should have an emergency clause or not. It's an idea that the Rüdigers and I did talk about, just so that the only purpose of a emergency clause would be to ensure that the counties are then come into compliance. And we're sort of going the other way around, making the law comply with what the practice is, but at the same time making sure that the exposures for the counties and for property owners is kept at a minimum.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it, panel. And we will call Thomas Matthews and Mark Carson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Matthews. I operate the liquor store at 52nd and Powell Boulevard in Portland. I speak only for myself, but there are quite a few people who have a like mind.
Mr. Matthews, were you going to testify on the horse barn issue?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. We've got you on the wrong sign-up sheet, but we'll move you over.
Okay.
I apologize.
I wanted to talk about 3130. Shall
okay.
I go back?
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
It's our mistake. Thank you. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3063? Okay. So many sign-up sheets, I think people get mixed up. Okay, that completes our testimony on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3063, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3063.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3063.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 3063. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair. I move House Bill 3063 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3063 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam
Is there a discussion? Representative Gallegos.
Would we want to unplug the emergency clause or to move in this bill?
Because, well, this is my thought on that. We are starting to look at a shortened session. And my concern is that bills that take much longer are not going to get through the whole process.
Can we not do an amendment here? And we've done it in other committees.
Yes, we can do a conceptual amendment when they discourage us from doing things that are not in writing. Representative Crummell, what would be your pleasure here? Do you want this to go to the floor immediately? Do you want us to hold it another 2 days?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Jerry Crummell. I think that you're absolutely correct. We are facing kind of a shortened time frame here, and if it would be the pleasure of the committee to go ahead and move the bill, and then what we could do is make the amendment of a emergency clause on the Senate side and then bring it back simply for a concurrency vote. And that would be fine with me if that meets with the pleasure of the committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Yep.
Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Berkeley?
Aye.
Representative Shockworth?
Aye.
Representative Kitt?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. Representative Crummell, would you like to carry your bill?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Thank you. No horses on the House floor, though. I'm sorry.
No horses on the
House. I think he should have one.
Close the work session on House Bill 3063. Thank you, everyone. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3097.
Do we want to have any
Committee, this bill is not ready, and so we are doing it. We had intended to have the hearing, but we are not going to do that now. So this is the hearing for this bill to keep it alive. So I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 3097. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2779. Have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2779 requires the State Apprenticeship and Training Council to approve without exception programs of apprenticeship and training that meet minimum guidelines set by the U.S. Department of Labor. Thank you.
I'm going to call Rick Thomas and John Killen and Dean Glover.
Morning. Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Killen. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for ABC here in Oregon. We represent about 400 businesses around the state, which also employ thousands of employees. We have about 200 apprentices in our current apprenticeship programs, and we hope to increase that number, continue to increase that number. Direct your attention to my written testimony, which you're getting now, which outlines our general arguments in favor of 2779. As you can see, we support this bill because we believe apprenticeship is a valuable tool for our industry, and a good program should be allowed to train and educate apprentices. As you will hear, good programs are being either denied or made to jump through a series of hoops to be allowed to provide training. We are particularly concerned with the needs test, a copy of which is in my testimony. This policy essentially says that bully can deny the application of an apprenticeship program if they don't feel it's necessary. You'll also note a letter from Bill Cover attached to my testimony, as the Federal Director of Apprenticeship under the U.S. Department of Labor here in Oregon. He has investigated Oregon's program because of problems stemming from practices such as using the needs test and other policies that they've stated there. So, why is this a problem? There's a variety of reasons and problems that occur to these rejections. And let me tell you briefly about one. Many jurisdictions require quotas for apprenticeship on public works contracts. Consequently, if your company doesn't have enough apprentices, or if there isn't an apprenticeship program for your particular trade, you can't work with that jurisdiction. And it's not your fault that you don't have apprentices. Your association wants to provide apprentices and apprenticeship training, but Bully won't let you because the program, which could be nationally recognized and awarded, isn't good enough for their case. These policies or standards aren't generally in rule or law. These are just ad hoc policies created by an advisory council, but they're pulled out of a drawer whenever needed to reject a program. These policies are used as if they were statute to tell an applicant why they can't have a program. ABC wants to strengthen our industry through training and education. What we are asking for in this bill is for the legislature to set in law that programs good enough to meet federal guidelines are good enough to help Oregon get to work. We hope we can count on your support.
Thank you.
Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Thomas, Executive Director of Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. IEC Oregon is an association of merit shop electrical and communication contractors throughout the state of Oregon. I come to you today to talk about competition and welcoming competition. For many years, IEC members have participated in registered apprenticeship programs throughout the state of Oregon. While it took many years and a great deal of work and perseverance for many years, our open shop programs be approved in electrical trade, our members were successful in their requested training. We worked with the budget to increase training, increase the number of people to being trained and the number of contractors trained. So more training exists, more training programs exist, training programs and training follows. It also forces programs to compete for individuals and contractors within the industry, leading to a better trained worker and better supply of skilled workers in our state. However, there are trades, like Mr. Killen mentioned, that have not been successful. Others will testify today about their challenges that they have faced in seeking to get training programs approved. Training programs that pay high wages and supply workers vital to our industry for growth and economic vitality in our state. Our contractors welcome open fair competition. Even when the State Apprenticeship Council has approved open shop programs in the state, they've held to a philosophy of still only allowing one multi-employer program on both the union and on the open shop side. Is this enough? Who knows? But what we're here to advocate for is that programs be allowed to compete and to compete for workers, compete for contractors, and increase the amount of skills and training that's taking place in the industry within our state. With that, I encourage you to support Council 2777.
Yeah, fellow committee, my name is Dean Glover with Hunter Davison. I'm part owner of Mechanical Contractor, HVAC, in Portland. I've been active on the HVAC, JATC in Area 1 for 13 years, plus or minus. I've been active in the industry for 27 years, so the HVAC industry is something I know well. Our industry, when it comes to training and apprenticeship, has a challenge. We have three distinct areas that we need to train people in: sheet metal, HVAC, and low voltage controls. It poses a challenge for our industry that every geographical area needs to deal with a little differently. Some areas geographically choose not to do sheet metal. Some do only service work. Most do low voltage work. They need flexibility in our industry to combine those three areas in our industry to not only employ workers, but also take care of our community and their customers. It creates a very fractionated trade, one that's difficult when it comes time to training. And in most areas, then, it's at least two or three apprenticeships to accommodate our trade. Each area needs that opportunity to marry or twin those three areas of our industry to do what's right for their geographical area to make their business go. We feel that it's definitely in the best interest of the areas to be able to do that and have the freedom of non-union as well as union opportunity in the training arena. I wanted to list or cite one example of an apprenticeship trying to spread their geographical boundaries, specifically Area 3 in the Eugene area, that primarily covers Lane and Douglas County. They also have Coos and Curry, but primarily Lane and Douglas County. They are a non-union sheet metal / HVAC JATC. They serve two counties primarily. There's two areas there, two areas of apprenticeship, HVAC and sheet metal. They had HVAC training in both counties, Lane and Douglas. They only had sheet metal training in Lane. Training agents in Douglas County requested and felt a definite need in the industry there to also support a sheet metal apprenticeship training, a non-union sheet metal program in Douglas County, just like they have in Lane County. They went before council, the Apprenticeship Training Council, and submitted to expand their geographical area so they could offer both HVAC and sheet metal in both Lane and Douglas County. I hope you're following this. So they had part of the industry. They wanted to support their training agents by having the complete package so they could do business in their geographical area. They were instructed by council at that point to they needed to get a letter from the union JATC, sheet metal JATC, that served Douglas County, that were already serving the county, that would state the union's position. not get their approval, just state their position. So an open shop JETC had to go to a union JETC to get their take or their opinion on opening the open shop apprenticeship in Douglas County. They did so, and the union's response was to deny the request. They went ahead and submitted this letter to the Apprenticeship and Training Council as required, and while they fulfilled previous council's members' requirements, they were denied the jurisdictional request. And a quote from the non-union JETC council member there says, "Council then additionally required us to meet face-to-face with the union representatives despite that requirement and the denial of our request being a clear violation of numerous federal and state rules, policies, and regulations." Council had apparently stipulated that they only wanted them to meet with the union sheet metal at JETC, not that they had to necessarily grant approval. It took 6 months to gain jurisdiction, and again, I quote that non-union JETC in Eugene, we do know one thing for sure, that no amount of maneuvers can repair. Council was blatantly out of compliance with CFR 29, Part 29, and having us kowtow to the union for 6 months before granting what was rightfully ours from the beginning. Council acted in arbitrary, fastidious, and biased fashion in favoring the union. 6 months of council harassment resulted in untold hours of wasted time and needless travel on our part. In a broader stroke, I'd like to just say to close that our industry needs support. We're trying currently even to get certification as an industry to bring the HVAC, sheet metal, and low voltage industries together, or all those components together, for a composite industry. We need support for that possible certification and opportunity to expand our apprenticeship possibilities, having every area of the state equally represented by union and non-union apprenticeships. What we don't need is interference and interpretation from Boley on the needs of our apprenticeship program in our industry and holding back its growth. That's the only way our industry is going to grow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Representative Shoffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming today, gentlemen. I've worked in construction in Iowa, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, in both non-union and union shops. Our union apprenticeship programs are recognized as among the best in the whole country. And I've been told that by Boley and by unions and non-union workers, and I also know it because I've been out there and I've worked with these men and women, and they're consummate professionals. And also, just for a side comment, editorial comment, if the word's allowed to compete, my opinion is nothing but allowed to make people work more for less money. That's my opinion. That's not my question. What exactly is it about the apprenticeship program as it exists in Oregon today that you find distasteful? And what are I would like the series of hoops you have to jump through. I think you've touched on that already. Thank you. And guidelines that are pulled out of the book that aren't pulled out of the book when it comes to union apprenticeship. What exactly is too stringent, too strict, and that you don't like anything more than you haven't said already?
First, let me respond to your first comment. We agree that many of the union training programs are top-notch, but as open shop workers, our folks don't want to join unions, and they simply want a choice. Further, to answer your other question, I think there will be more folks coming up here to testify to some of the hoops that they've had to jump through specifically. I don't have the numbers and the specifics right in front of me. I think probably the needs test is one of the better examples that we have of something out there that has caused a lot of problems. I could go into a lot of detail, but I think I'll let the further testimony that's coming outline some of those issues.
Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Killen, I guess I'm a little perplexed what you're really trying to achieve with this bill, because clearly we have to meet the federal standards right now, and the letter you supplied us from the DOL makes it clear that they're ensuring that we do by looking at our program. But it seems like the language of your bill would make it impossible for our state to have any standards that exceed the federal, which we do on OSHA and numerous other areas where we regulate, and we wouldn't be able to have programs that are tailored in any way to the Oregon-specific situation. So I don't understand what you're really trying to get at. Don't we have to meet the federal standards already, but simply have the ability to have standards that go beyond those?
Actually, I think I'll try to answer that best I can. I guess to clarify, all apprenticeship programs, whether meaning the federal standard, meaning the state standard, are local programs, and so they're run by local contractors, local members of the industry who are setting the rules for that apprenticeship program and setting what the minimum training requirements are and what the guidelines are for training within that program. And so the control still remains local, because that's where the training committees are. Those are the people that are setting the policy. On this pursuit, we're simply discussing the process for that training program, getting their standards and their guidelines for their program approved.
Representative Carr.
How many apprenticeship programs meet federal guidelines but are denied by the state? Do you have any idea?
Try to answer that question. Well, right now, since in Oregon, to be considered an apprenticeship program, it has to be registered with the Oregon State Apprenticeship Council, and so you wouldn't have a situation where a program would be officially federally approved, but not it would be federally approved, because right now the process is you have to go through the State Apprenticeship Council.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I don't mean literally approved. What I'm saying is, how many apprenticeship programs that you know would meet the minimum federal guidelines do not get approved by the Oregon Council?
I think you'll, coming up in testimony after us, I think other organizations that be testifying better be able to show examples and show programs. I think Mr. Glover kind of showed a situation of a program that wouldn't quite meet the federal guidelines.
Additionally, each association, IEC, ABC, AGC, etc., has nationally recognized programs that their associations have put together over the years for a variety of trades. So assumably, each of those groups would have a program for each of the trades they cover. I'm not sure if we could put a number on it, but it would be quite a few.
Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. Committee, we have about 24 people to testify on this bill. We have about a little over 35 minutes. I want to go to the next bill at 9:40. So I'm going to call them up quickly and ask them to keep their remarks to 1 minute. But first, we will bring up our Labor Commissioner, Ann Gardner, and Steve Sims from Boley.
1 minute, Dan. Ready?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I'm done.
Okay.
Thanks for coming.
One limit.
Okay.
1 minute for does not apply to you.
All right. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and still recovering legislator. But anyway, this morning I'm testifying in obviously in opposition to this particular House bill. You have several pieces of written testimony from me in front of you. I think really to cut to the core of it is that apprenticeship in the state of Oregon predates the federal program. We were the second state in the nation to set up apprenticeship in 1931. As a graduate of an apprenticeship program, it's something certainly near and dear to my heart. Even as a legislator in this place, it was one of the areas I heavily concentrated on. And I think the thing to remember more than anything else about apprenticeship programs is the economic development aspect to them. We get a return of 5 to 1 for the investment on apprenticeship programs. If you look at programs, over 2,600 average completions per biennium. Graduates and completers of those programs then generate $53,560,000 in state and federal taxes. If you figure only one quarter of that comes to the state of Oregon, it would roughly come to about $13,390,000. Apprenticeship programs are absolutely incredibly important and incredibly important to this state. And I guess I'd rather go on about the value of apprenticeship programs, simply to get to the core of what this bill is really about. And it really isn't about a union, non-union issue, as was presented earlier. To give you some rough numbers, there are 77 union programs across the state, 63 non-union, and 28 that are mixed, that are both union and non-union, and work very, very well. What the needs test is about is saying, if there is a pre-existing program in an area, why can't you see first, before your program is set up, if you can work with that pre-existing program and train together? And I think that's the important aspect to remember out of this, is that there are programs that work well and work well together. It's not, if the pre-existing program happened to be union, it would be a non-union then going in and talking to a union program. If the program that was pre-existing happened to be a non-union program, it would be the union program that would have to go in and talk to them about whether or not they could work out an agreement to train together and save state dollars, basically, and to save training dollars. That's the whole concept of it. As far as a program taking 6 months, I can't specifically talk to this particular program that they're mentioning, but I can tell you that the Apprenticeship Council only meets once every 3 months. That means that it took them 2 meetings to get a particular program approved, which is not a tremendously long time for the council. I will say that if you look at apprenticeship over the history of the last several years, I was here as a member sitting somewhere about where Representative Rosenbaum was, as I recall, and in 1999. Prior to that, apprenticeship programs were technically state agencies. If their program wasn't running well, what would happen is the Bureau of Labor and Industries would go in and basically run the program. They were given Attorney General's support as far as legal issues and legal advice. They were actually given insurance under the state and insured by the state. In the 99 legislature, decided that apprenticeship programs needed to rise or fall on their own merit at that point in time. And the concentration of my predecessor, Commissioner Roberts, was that of compliance, to make sure that programs out there were actually training young people to a true and meaningful career. I have seen documentation of some programs where, quite frankly, what they do is you can look at them over a 5 or 6 year period of time, you can find 4 or 5 individuals within that program that were brought into a program, started to be trained, and 3 months later dropped from the program. The program was basically dropped, and then it would mysteriously start up about a year later. If you also look at other documents, that seemed to correlate with when prevailing wage contracts for particular contractors in that field started up. Those are not programs that this state needs, because you're not meaningfully training young people to a profession. That's why the standards are there. That's why programs, when they want to start up, are made to jump through a few hoops, to show that they have a meaningful structure of financing, that they have a meaningful structure of apprenticeship criteria and training, to show that they really are training young people to a lifetime career.
Dan, and I wonder if you could address the specific allegations that are in the letter from William Kober of the U.S. Department of Labor, saying that that they're investigating compliance and that they've done a similar investigation in California. What are your comments about that?
My comments directly about that, there are two particular things that you may want to be aware of, is that the Department of Labor has, in fact, taken California to court on this particular issue, and that's working its way through the courts. And until there's resolution on that, I mean, obviously, depending on how the outcome of that, it's a question of whether the needs test in Oregon continues to exist or not. Associated General Contractors, also on my second day in office, I was presented with a lawsuit against my predecessor, Commissioner Roberts, on a particular program that's out there. Those are working their way through the courts, and there's no action I think the Bureau can or should appropriately take until they work their way through.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Garrard.
Dan, I know you still only have had a couple months on the job, so this is somewhat of a tough question. But
I'm almost my fourth.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting there.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's an apprentice.
But I've got backup here, Madam Chair, Representative Garrard. Steve Sims is with me, who is the director of the Apprenticeship Division.
Is there, to your knowledge, a union bias in the selection of council-approved apprentice programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, having only chaired one council meeting and still working through meeting with every single one of the council members for either a breakfast or lunch, which I've done three already this week, I couldn't begin to tell you yet. I really need to talk to those folks more and have more experience to give you a definitive answer. My gut reaction would be most every person I have talked to so far cares solely about quality training for apprentices, be they non-union or union.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you for coming. And I had this question with the last panel, but to kind of hesitate because I wasn't sure where it was going. But your testimony here tells me that maybe there is something to it. And it's, you know, you always have to follow the money. So my question is what is the public expenditure then to each of these programs, or categorize it, the public expenditure then to union programs, and what's the public expenditure then to non-union programs?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, it varies, but if you'd like a general answer, I can generally talk to you about how union programs fund their programs versus non-union programs. Is that what you're asking, or?
Well, that would be a good answer, but it'd be good to know. I mean, clearly there's costs involved. Money must be an issue here, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, how that's...
Well, the money, Representative Gallegos, that is an issue is whether or not there is adequate dollars spent on training so that there is meaningful training out there. That's one of the criteria that the Apprenticeship Council looks at to see that program has the ability to have a quality education for each and every student to make sure that they, when they, you know, complete their program, that they have a meaningful career and meaningful training to, you know, toward the end of that career.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up quickly, please.
Is there a public expenditure to these programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, we certainly have an apprenticeship and training division with
yes,
several.
No, I mean, there is a public expenditure.
A public expenditure as far as the Bureau of Labor and Industries direct. I guess I'm not understanding your question, whether you're asking about the direct cost of the apprenticeship and training division and what we expend as a state in order to do compliance reviews, set up programs, and work with those programs to see that they meet EEOC standards and other things, which, of course, there is an expenditure to the state through the Bureau of Labor and Industries for those particular employees that we have in the apprenticeship division. There is also a state expenditure that comes through the community colleges on an FTE basis for the number of individuals out there that are being trained that are accessed in different ways by different programs, and they're currently being changed overall through the community college system. Most programs are privately funded out there. The union programs, for instance, in a generality, is privately funded both by an expenditure of employer and employee contribution to that program and very little, if any, public dollars. Most, if you want a generality, non-union programs are funded by a public expenditure through a community college on an FTE basis, and they charge their students, and in some cases more dollars per semester hour than that of what a community college would charge? If that gets at your answer.
I think that was a yes. But and if later you
that was a conditional yes, I think.
I think so. But if later I could get some just very simple graphs or charts, not graphs, but some charts just to kind of break down what those are. I'd just love that. That would just help me clarify that. And I'll leave you there.
Representative Chair, Representative Gallegos, I'd be happy to do that, although we couldn't do it in color. There's a governor's mandate on that.
I have crayons. I can do my own thing.
Okay.
They look a lot better in color, though.
We need to move onward, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we're going to call up Bob Shipwreck, Dan Campbell, Bob Kynes. And, gentlemen, I'm going to have to hold you 1 minute since we have so many people signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. There are about 20 to 25 individuals here. However, we've asked them not to speak.
And is that right? Okay.
Yes. Not all of them, as in the interest of time.
Okay.
I wanted to just make a couple quick comments. One of the things that I think the committee needs to understand and why we have these Chapter 660 on apprenticeship is apprenticeship is about protecting the kids that are in the program. That's the number one thing, to teach them a career that they can go on and help the industry involved and the employers. It's not set up for the employers or the unions or anybody else. It's for the people that are applied to the program. So that's what we have to be concentrating on. This bill would, in my opinion, lead to a proliferation of committees that we would have to then expend more money on monitoring. And it also would tend, in my opinion, to limit the number. If you had a proliferation of programs, limit the number of contractors, or we call them training agents, out there that these individuals could go to. In construction, this is not a guaranteed annual wage. Clearly, with the recession we're going through, people need to be able to move around and get other experience. If you're going to be a cement mason, for instance, you can't just do curbs, gutters, and sidewalks for 3 or 4 years and call yourself a journeyman. You have to get other types of experience, industrial, commercial, etc. And so a small number of training agents would limit these apprentices' ability to get the experience that they need to get. I'm disappointed that it was testified that this is a union, non-union issue, and I think that Dan Gardner did an outstanding job pointing out that when you look at the statistics, you really can't read that into it. And the last thing, the last comment I'll make, and it was also alluded to by the proponents, there seems to be an inordinate amount of interest in apprenticeship only to meet certain goals set by the federal or state government requiring training on jobs. Unfortunately, we have too many young people who get into an apprenticeship program. They're there for one or two jobs where those requirements are in, and then they're let go. I call them one-job wonders. They never make it through the whole apprenticeship cycle, graduate, and be journeymen. And my last point, that fact, Madam Chair, has led to a real inability in some cases, particularly in the minority community, to recruit young people into the apprenticeship programs because they've been through that situation where they thought they were getting into something real, and they weren't, and they were let go. I'll stop right there.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Bob Kynes. I'm the training director for Local 290 Plumbers and Steam Fitters. I'm also a member of the Plumbing Board and a big believer in Oregon's public boards. I see this bill as just an effort to completely subvert the State Apprenticeship Council and the public process that we go through in the state of Oregon. I've dealt with backflow issues where it was taken away from the state of Oregon and sent up to Washington, and we had to go up and kowtow to Washingtonians for our own backflow program. Gratefully, we got that back several years ago, but I would much prefer to deal with the state of Oregon. As far as compliance goes, Mr. Kober, as a representative for the state of Oregon, covers about 7 states, 1 person. Okay, there's 2 people in the Northwest from the Bureau of Labor and from the Department of Labor that handle apprenticeship. And you know, nothing against them, but there's not enough of them for the programs that exist. And so compliance, this would pretty much cut the head off of compliance for apprenticeship, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dan Campbell, Training Director for Central Electrical Training Center in Tangent. We train about 170 apprentices and 600 to 800 journeymen a year at our facility in Tangent and a facility we share with the plumbers and pipe fitters in Central Oregon. Commissioner Gardner and Mr. Shiprack have really covered the key points that I would have addressed today, but I would just like to point out that this is an issue of quality, and the State Apprenticeship Council has worked very hard to assure quality in apprenticeship for the benefit of those people going through the training programs and assuring that they have a career in front of them when they complete their training. Oregon's apprenticeship right now is well respected throughout the nation. People who graduate from our programs literally have a capability because of the skills they learn to go all over the country, and I have the opportunity to meet with other people in my capacity from around the country, and I'm reminded constantly of the high quality of the people that we send to them on those occasions when we can't provide work here in Oregon. I would also like to take this opportunity to invite you, Representative Close, and the other members of the committee to visit our training center in Tangent. It's a state-of-the-art facility. We're very proud of it, and it was built without the use of state funding. Our contractors, the members of our local union, have put the money together, and they're very proud of that facility. We'd like to see you come down and see what we really do for training.
Thank you. Bob, let me ask you, the situation between Eugene and Roseburg, where it took them the 6 months to get the program, are you aware of that situation that Mr. Glover talked about, and can you comment on that?
Madam Chairman, I'm not aware of that situation. I don't attend all the council meetings because I've got so many folks in my organization that, like Dan here, that's his life, that they go to it. But I did respect the, Mr. Gardner's response. By statute, the council only meets once a quarter, so it took two meetings. That's pretty quick, if you ask me.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, call Jessica Harris, Dan Graham, Harlow Harris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and we're here to testify in support of this bill. I want to take a moment just up front and clarify, AGC was not the organization that filed the lawsuit to Bully. We did, it was a group of contractors who were concerned about the needs test. I want to let you know, the average age of a construction worker in the state of Oregon is 45. So this is not a state that can afford to not have as many training opportunities as possible for contractors. Quite frankly, they're going to retire in a hurry, and we need to have as many young people as possible trained and ready to take those positions as soon as possible. This issue shouldn't be a political issue. And quite frankly, I'm disappointed that we have to be here today asking you to pass this bill in order to get programs approved. Training shouldn't be political. We should have as many programs as possible. Representative Shoffler, we agree. Union programs are great programs, and we have often said they're wonderful organizations and they do a good job. But we also say our programs are great. We have many programs. They do a great job. They meet federal standards. They are accredited through a national organization. And we believe that we also offer good training. It's not about having to choose between one or the other. It's about having opportunities, good programs across the industry that are available to everyone. And we believe that we can offer that. Quite frankly, 6 months is a short period of time. We've been trying for 3 years to get our programs approved. You'll hear more about that from Dan Graham, who's our apprenticeship manager. Our folks aren't saying, no, we don't want to work with the unions. We're saying, we would like to have our own program. We have our own way of doing things. And it isn't not legitimate. It is a way of doing business that we like to do business with our employees. They like to do business with us in a certain way. And that shouldn't be denied because certain folks think that that isn't the way they do business, so we should do it the way they do it. These programs are good programs. They're accredited. We need more workers. And this issue, we should have as many opportunities as possible. And if I can't hammer home that point, I haven't done my job today. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Graham, who on a daily basis administers our apprenticeship programs for AGC. He can talk to you about what these programs are and why they work the way they do.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Graham. I'm the workforce manager for Associated General Contractors, and it's my job to encourage or nag or do whatever I can to get all of our employer members to take up their responsibility to train the future workforce of this industry. And as Jessica pointed out, we have both union and non-union members. We want all of them to take up their responsibility. And we think that it is incredibly important for the state of Oregon to encourage them to do that. This is important to our industry, and we think if it's important to our industry, it's probably important to the state of Oregon that we encourage people to train their employees to advance in their careers, to earn more money. That helps communities and so forth. This is simply a matter of allowing employers who want to train to have the program that they want to train with. As Jessica indicated, we're probably the case study in why the system is broke. We have been trying to get two apprenticeship programs approved, and I administer six now. We had tried to get two masons, brick and cement masons, approved for 3 years. We're still at it. It has gotten national attention. The Federal Department of Labor has said, yes, we should be approved. We've met all of the requirements that we have been required to meet. That has also been stated by Apprenticeship Director Steve Sims, that we have met the requirements. Unfortunately, it's become political. But I would just ask you, if the shoe were on the other foot, if the other side was asked to train exclusively for the non-union side, how would you feel if you were a union supporter? I would resent that. If I was a union supporter, I would say, no, we have our own program and we have our own way of going about it. What we're asking here is simply equal access to a very fundamental right, and that's education and training. I hope you take this very seriously. We certainly do, and yes, I'm supporting these groups that have filed the lawsuit, and we think we're going to win. I would rather that you solve the problem here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Council, my name is Harlow Harris. I'm a bricklayer and a masonry contractor here in Salem. I would like to address a couple things that have been said about quality. We did a little bit of investigating open shops. I've received numerous awards for the work that we have done for the last 20 years in the Willamette Valley and elsewhere. I pay for my apprentices to go to our program, which has been alive and well at Chemeketa for over a year now. I also pay wages that are very comparable to union, if not in some cases far beyond that. That's how you get quality people. I've trained apprentices for 20 years without any kind of a formal program. We have decided that it's time, because we have more than the share of the market these days, to step up and take the responsibility of having a formal apprenticeship program. And we have moved forward on that. I am an Oregonian, born, lived here every day of my life. And there's one thing that I'm concerned about, and that is the economic health of this state, which is in dire need of some serious attention. Competition, I don't know what that word means to you, but it means everything to me. It means health and vibrance. The union people, they have a great program. I'm not contesting that at all. I think that we also have a good program, the beginning of a good program, and I think it would behoove the state to actually take a look at the federal mandates carefully and not be swayed by one side or the other. And having said that,
I just make a quick comment. Failed to mention, yes.
Please give your name for the record.
Dan Graham, I'm sorry. We are training. We've been training our apprentices. They're not recognized yet by the state of Oregon, but they are in training, and we call them apprentices. We're training them at Chemeketa Community College now for the last year and a half. It's fully accredited, fully recognized by Chemeketa Community College, and we use a nationally accredited curriculum. And frankly, I'm shocked to hear that training people at the community colleges is a bad thing. Since when? We get excellent service there that we pay for on a separate contract that totally supported financially by these contractors. Why is that a bad thing? We would like to see more of that. And in terms of quality, no one that I know of in this debate is asking that the quality level be lowered one bit. We'll stand up to the quality measure that anybody else stands up to. And I challenge anyone to show otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Schaffner.
You all said that, Mr. Graham, I believe, that you have your own way of going about it. Well, I've had the pleasure of being a HOD carrier for almost a year. And a bond beam on a non-union site is a bond beam on a union site. Is a bond beam is a bond beam. So there isn't really, I mean, if you're a bricklayer, I'm a site. I just wanted to use that because it was, you're a bricklayer. And I love bricklayers. Anyway, and I do take this seriously. But, you know, I don't think this is about quality. And I don't think it's about community colleges. And I don't think it's about politics.
Representative Schaffer, you will have a chance when we get to the discussion on this bill to give your opinion. But we have 5 minutes, so if you could ask the question.
I think this is about money. My question is, do the folks that go through non-union apprenticeships and become journeymen and women make equal pay and get equal benefits to union apprenticeships and journeymen?
I'd like to answer that question. All apprenticeship programs are required to survey the contractors and establish by state policy what the average journey wage is. We have done that for these two programs, and their average is in excess of the union wage. That's been established. This is not about money.
Thank you very much, panel. I'm going to call our last panel. Chris Davies, Jerry Gallaman, Sheet Metal Apprenticeship. Having trouble reading the writing. Somebody from NECA. Is it Harkus? Or is it Harris? I'm sorry. Yes.
Him too.
I'm sorry. Welcome.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's an honor to be here before you this morning. My name is Terry Hatch and I represent the Oregon Pacific Cascade Chapter, NECA, and Eugene. I've been involved in apprenticeship training since 85 and have acted as an instructor, apprenticeship coordinator, trustee. Currently, I'm a trustee on three IBW NECA joint apprenticeship programs. Train apprentices from over 200 electrical contractors from Woodburn to Medford and Bend to Coos Bay and Newport. Working jointly to create and maintain a quality workforce is a goal that we do more than just brag about. We put our money in behind that commitment. In the three programs that I mentioned, our financial commitment to apprenticeship and training is in excess of $1 million per year. Nationwide, there are organizations that say they promote apprenticeship training, but they're not backed up their claims with facts or money. They say they want to create more training opportunities, but if you check with Bowling, you'll find that they have a very low graduation rate, which is exactly the whole idea behind apprenticeship. Oregonians should be extremely proud of the standards that exist regarding apprenticeship and training. State Apprenticeship and Training Council has done an excellent job of creating training programs that are the envy of many states. In Montana and Idaho, where I was an instructor and a trustee, the training is done under the Department of Labor guidelines. I can tell you from personal experience, the standards that are in place in the United States Department of Labor are much weaker, not administered adequately, and are ultimately less than successful in turning out well-trained craftsmen and women to replace those who have retired or left the industry. This is a place we don't want to go, and it would be a huge step backward for Oregon. We must demand quality for the professionals in our state. No one would ever dream of dropping the standard that doctors, dentists, or other professionals must meet to practice their given disciplines in Oregon. Why should we even consider lowering the standards for our craftsmen? Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Madam Chair, Council Members, my name is Jared Gorn. I'm the Training Director for Sheet Metal Apprenticeship in Portland, Oregon. Speaking to the fact of taking 6 months to get into Douglas County, I know what went on there. Basically, when anybody starts a new program, the Bureau of Labor and Industries requires that somebody else has those standards in that area, you have to go talk to them first. The non-union contractor did not do that. He went to council, and council basically told him they have to go talk to him. They went and talked to Doug McCleary, who's my counterpart in the southern part of Oregon, and they were talking about training together. At that point in time, we were in the process of making it one statewide standard. That's the reason it took 6 months. I believe that if they'd gone there to begin with, they probably would have got that a lot faster. We have our training center part. We've invested $3.5 billion in. We train basically statewide. There's a little bit up in Northeast Oregon. It's done out of Washington State, but we've invested it. We have a top-notch training center. We've turned out over 80% of our apprentices that come into the program are turned out. We've even gone one step further in dealing with the apprentices, and we feel this is an apprentice issue in training. We've gone to Mount Hood Community College and Oregon Department of Education. Our apprentices now are required when they go through the apprenticeship program, they graduate with an associate's degree in sheet metal technology. This is six credit hours over and above. The JATC and Training Trust stepped up to the plate, said they would pay for that. So our apprentices actually graduate from our program now with a degree, and these are all transferable to OYT for a bachelor's degree. And we feel in our industry, in the apprenticeship world, that's what it's all about. It's about the apprentice, about giving them opportunity, and about giving them good training. Thank you.
That's very good to hear.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Chris Davis. I'm with the Oregon Southwest Washington Cement Masons Apprenticeship. I'm here to oppose House Bill 2779. The bill, if approved, would remove the authority from the Oregon State Apprenticeship Council to establish guidelines for new programs. It would force the Oregon State Apprenticeship Council to register any program meeting those minimum Department of Labor guidelines and then try to hold them accountable in the future. This is a backwards policy. Oregon has always used federal guidelines as minimums and then has raised the bar to a higher level. The high quality of apprenticeship from Oregon speaks for itself. This bill would also create duplicate programs. Oregon State Apprenticeship Council policy currently requires that all existing programs be open to all contractors and their employers on a non-discriminatory basis. We currently train both open and closed shop apprentices. We don't discriminate in the slightest. More programs would just mean more duplication and more cost for the system. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I could real quick, I would, anytime you're up in Portland, we'd love to have you stop by and take a look at our training facility and our state-of-the-art facility we have and talk to our apprentices that we do training.
Thank you. I do appreciate the work that you're all doing. Thank you very much, panel. I'd like to say for the rest of the people that are signed up, we will take your written testimony. We have tried to take the testimony that it was indicated were the top people here to testify today. I think both sides have been presented, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this point, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2779. And our next bill is 2908, committee. We have people here that come from Portland to testify on 3130, so we're going to quickly take 2908 and then go right into 3130. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2908. Staff will read the summary. Representative Delto, are you in the room? John Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2908 clarifies that advertisements regarding insurance policy in languages other than English may not be construed to modify the policy. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Delto.
Thank you. Chair Polish, members of the committee. For the record, Billy Delto, Oregon State Representative, Oregon House District 21. I just wanted to say a few words to introduce House Bill 2908. I think it's a good piece of consumer protection. Right now, insurance companies are weary of advertising foreign languages, foreign language stations, because of concerns about liability. What this would do would be to, the effect of this bill would be to encourage insurance companies to put advertisements in foreign languages, and I think what that would do is make folks aware of insurance that they need to have and how to obtain insurance. So I think it's a pretty good bill. So that's all I have.
Can I ask you, Representative Dalto, was there a certain constituent that had a problem with this issue of yours?
It was brought to my attention by Legislative Council, Government Relations Council, John Powell, so I would defer any questions to John Powell.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me this morning is Steve Merle, an attorney with State Farm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Dalto has pointed out, the intent of House Bill 2908 is to encourage further advertising in foreign language media, such as newspapers, radio stations, and television. The current law in this area and this amendment are designed specific to try to promote for companies like State Farm who do try to advertise in foreign languages and support both minority-owned radio television stations, but also televised at a national level in foreign languages. This goal is accomplished in part by what we passed in 1997. Passed the current law, which if you look at the materials that I have provided you, the existing law is one half of the bill we introduced in 1997. And that current law states that an insurer who advertises in a foreign language need not provide an insurance policy in that foreign language as long as the ads they use state that it's available only in English. And as Representative Dalto has just pointed out, it's important for people who are not fluent in English to know what is available in the insurance market, particularly in those lines where insurance is required. House Bill 2908 completes the legislation that we passed in 1997 by adding a provision that advertisements regarding insurance policy in languages other than English may not be construed to modify the policy. An insurance policy is unlike other commodities that are sold through the media. If you buy a wheelbarrow that was advertised on television, there's no interpretation except for the instructions that may be poorly written on how to put it together. An insurance policy, every single word almost has been litigated over time. So it's very important as to the rules of that litigation because of the mere nature of an insurance policy. So what House Bill 2908 does is simply clarify in the law that disputes over any language in the policy will be determined based on the English language. Now, that is the current law. We do not have a case in Oregon. This is not overturning a case in Oregon. It's simply to make sure from the get-go that we don't have those kinds of cases. In 1997, this language that's before you today, in essence, was in the bill that we put forward. It passed the Senate, came to the House, and when the bill got to the floor, Representative Amy, who was a member at the time, raised some questions about one of the sections in the bill. And if you look at, I think it's three pages from the end, there is a letter from Legislative Council answering the questions that Representative Amy posed, and that is, would this language actually allow an insurance company to get away with advertising? And would a consumer lose the right to sue under common law if the advertising was false? The answer to both of those questions is no. And that's what this opinion said. If you look at the date of that letter, it was June 11, 1997. I didn't see it until about a week after that period. It was too late. The committee was closed. And it was too late to get the bill back off the floor after it had been there once and taken back for this correction. It was too late to correct the record. Since 1997, this has been going to be on our legislative agenda, but other matters took precedence over, so we're just getting back to clarifying the law in this area. Also attached to what I've handed out to you is a letter of support from a national Latino organization that was provided to us in 1997, as well as an article on two Spanish-speaking radio stations here in the Willamette Valley. In fact, one of the women featured in this article, Representative Galto, told me this morning did cut an ad for him in Spanish for the radio during his campaign. So, Madam Chairman and members, with that, I'll stop and answer any questions that you might have on this matter.
Thank you, John. Questions? Representative Shoffler.
First of all, thank you for your patience with me today, Madam Chair.
That's
my
okay.
My question is, first, this is a great idea. On my canvas, the northern part of my district, and there's any number of folks that speak any number of languages. My question is this, a week after June 11th, the session was closed. Does that mean we're going to be done at June 18th?
Madam Chair, I wish.
Okay.
The session was not quite over then, but the committee was closed.
Oh.
And I would imagine about that time, committees here will be closed as well. It doesn't mean you're out of here.
Oh. Okay.
And in fact, in this session, 1997 was calm compared to the budget problems you have swirling here.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This concludes our witnesses on the bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2908. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2908.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garrard.
I would move House Bill 2908 to the floor as amended. With a due pass recommendation?
I don't believe we have amended it, Representative.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Then I will just simply make the motion to move House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Okay. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Both aye. Motion carries. And I'm going to appoint a carrier. Representative Rosenbaum, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2908. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3130. And this is Representative Miller's bill. He has been detained, so he cannot be with us. So we're going to have the staff read the summary and call up Matt Lowe and Peter, is it Grail?
Grail. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3130 does a number of things. It eliminates the role of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission in importing, warehousing, and retailing of distilled liquors. It creates off-premises distilled liquor license, authorizes holder of license to sell factory-sealed containers of distilled liquor for consumption off the licensed premises, allows holder of license to establish prices of distilled liquor, establishes conditions and fees for off-premises distilled liquor license, creates a wholesale liquor license, prohibits importation, storage, transportation, wholesale, sale or distribution of distilled liquor without wholesale liquor license, establishes conditions and fees for a wholesale liquor license, imposes a privileged tax on distilled liquor, and this becomes operative July 4th, 2004. And the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Peter Grafel. I'm the agent at Agency 193 in Eugene. I've been there since 1985. and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of this important bill. There are many reasons for taking the progressive step of changing the way the state of Oregon handles the sale of distilled spirits. First of all, the state needs to comply with state and federal labor laws as well as conform to IRS regulations. The second point is, as a business, the current system is inefficient and very expensive. Attempts at forming a cooperative business relationship between liquor agents and the OLCC have failed. This is exposing the state to civil rights violation claims and numerous lawsuits that must be defended at taxpayers' expense. There are currently 6 lawsuits filed against the OLCC by various liquor agents, and the state is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars defending themselves and their system. We support the main point of HB 3130, the creation of wholesale and retail liquor licenses. Out of the 18 controlled states, over half of them have made changes in their ways of handling the sales utilizing this principle, and it has proven very successful. The Liquor Commission has 2 main goals with regard to liquor sales and the agent's current responsibility for these sales. Number one is that all revenue due to the state is collected and deposited into proper state coffers, and that the number 2 point is that sales are handled in a socially responsible manner, especially regarding sales to minors and intoxicated people. The revenue stream currently provided by liquor sales can be preserved by establishing a tax rate to be imposed at the wholesale level, the same way beer and wine are currently handled. Further financial savings would be agents would purchase the liquor inventory. It would be a one-time savings of approximately $20 million. The OLCC warehouse, which uses outdated equipment that is difficult and expensive to maintain, and put the property onto the tax rolls. At a projected sales price of about $15 million, this would generate $300,000 plus a year in property taxes for the state. With private industry responsible for warehousing, 50 workers could be eliminated from state employment and PERS benefits. These workers can be transferred to other agencies or work for private industry using their experience. Another 20 positions could be eliminated from the retail division of the OLCC, since extensive oversight over daily sales and store operations would no longer be needed. Liquor retailers would still be subject to laws regarding sales to minors and intoxicated individuals, which are enforced by local law enforcement agencies. Agents would be very happy to assist in work sessions to help with research and offer their many years of experience to accomplish these same changes. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Peter, how do you say your last name?
Grateful.
Grateful.
Mm-hmm.
So you are an agent in Eugene?
Yes, right? I am.
How many years have you been an agent?
There since 1985, and prior to that I started in 1978, so I've been an agent for 25 years now.
I see. So you have extensive background.
Yes, very much so.
Questions from the committee? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, and gentlemen, thank you for appearing this morning. Do you think the result of this bill would be that liquor would become less expensive or more readily available to the citizens of our state?
I think that depends on how the bill would be handled. If the sales would be limited through a system of contractors, which number would be limited, which makes it similar to what it is now, I don't think that the sales would increase that much. If, on the other hand, the grocery industry feels that they are to have a piece of this business and we would more than double the number of licenses, there's a good chance that sales would increase. But I don't think that that would increase consumption necessarily, because this would just allow the customer in the grocery store to have a bigger choice. Right now they can just purchase beer and wine there, which constitute about 80% of the liquor sales in the state, and hard liquor is about 20%. And the price, I think, would be determined by the amount of taxes that the legislature would feel they would need to collect. You would determine the amount of revenue you need from that industry, and agents would collect it for you. And I think that has a lot to do with sales that would be generated. I have no idea at this point if sales, I mean, if the price would go down or not. That I think right now the markup on hard liquor is 108%. So you can see that that is the biggest point that would influence how much you sell of it. It's always a price question.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification then. The bill as written would allow the sale of hard liquor in grocery stores?
Representative Close and Representative Merkley, I don't believe that that is very clearly pointed out. It's kind of a gray area the way I understand that bill at this point. There's a possibility that it could be allowed, but it doesn't specifically mention that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Matt?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Lowe. I'm an attorney with the law firm of O'Donnell and Clark, and we represent liquor agents Daryl Morgan, Peter Graple, and Robert Hessler, who have filed the lawsuit against the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The fundamental matter at issue in this lawsuit is the appropriate characterization of the relationship between the OLCC and its liquor agents. Under present law, as interpreted by various Oregon agencies, including the Oregon Employment Department, the Department of Consumer Business Services, and the Department of Revenue, and has been as has been applied by those agencies to both private businesses and public agencies in Oregon, the relationship between these parties is that of employer-employee and not of independent contracting parties. While several factors are considered in determining whether an employment relationship exists, perhaps the most important is the level of direction and control that is applied by the OLCC to its liquor agents. In short, the Oregon Supreme Court has held that the crux of this issue is determining whether the presumptive employer is dictating the manner and means of accomplishing the work at issue, which results in finding an employment relationship, or whether they are simply setting certain requirements and desiring certain outcomes, which indicates a relationship between independent contracting parties. It is our opinion that under applicable employment law, as well as the statutes and regulations governing the OLCC, that the OLCC's extensive oversight of liquor agents and their operations has the effect of controlling the manner and means of delivering services rather than simply dictating a desired result. As such, the OLCC is required to provide the same level of benefits to its liquor agent employees and the state as a whole does for its public employees. Such benefits include contributions and participation in the public employees' retirement system, payment of unemployment insurance taxes, and the payment of workers' compensation premiums. Now, that's the very broad outline of the nature of our client's lawsuit against the OLCC. And I mailed to each of you yesterday an executive summary of this lawsuit, and be happy to provide you a copy of the full complaint if you want to work through that. However, you may be wondering how this lawsuit ties into AB 3130 before you today. And I just want to make two brief points in this regard. First, there will be a cost to the state associated with our client's victory in this lawsuit. The OLCC will no longer be able to avoid its obligation to provide employment benefits to its liquor agents, which includes all the employees of each of these liquor agents as well. So you can see a substantial increase in the number of employees that go on the state payroll. In the overall scheme of things, this may not appear to be a large amount of money, but these costs are real, and they can be entirely avoided if this bill is passed. Second, with heavy regulation and oversight comes a heavy cost. The OLCC Retail Operations Manual includes detailed requirements pertaining to shelving, merchandising, store appearance, employee appearance, employee conduct, relationships with distributors, restrictions on the sale of items completely unrelated to alcohol, bank deposits, signage, and the list goes on and on. While I do not want to engage in a debate over the individual merits of each of these items, my point here is that it costs a lot of money to oversee and enforce these provisions. In the end, passage of HB 3130 will save the state a very significant amount of money, a portion of which is attributable to the issues I just mentioned. But beyond that, it is also important to carefully consider whether the OLCC is serving a necessary governmental function. The argument that the OLCC is serving a necessary governmental function would be substantially more persuasive if the sale of beer and wine, representing 80% of all alcohol sales in Oregon, as Pete just mentioned, were subject to the same level of oversight and control exercised in the sale of liquor. But this is not the case. The reality is that unless the state deems it in its interest to control the retail sale of all alcoholic beverages in the state, which would be a highly questionable and debatable interest, then there is simply no reason to continue with an overly expensive, inefficient, and oppressive regulatory regime for the sale of liquor. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this important issue and look forward to its passage in the coming weeks.
Thank you very much. Representative Girard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This bill really isn't about helping the state find more revenue or whether the state of Oregon would actually lose revenue out of such a move. It's not about trying to find a lower price or create a lower price for the consumer. It's really all about employer-employee relationship between the state and its agents. Is that correct?
Bill?
Yes.
No, I don't think this... I mean, my understanding of this bill, that's not the... I mean, this bill is more of a philosophical approach to whether the state should be in the business of selling liquor, my understanding. And I will admit I don't have the background that a lot of these other people are going to have in this whole broader issue. I'm much more focused on an employee-employee-employee-employer relationship issue. But that's a result from passage of this bill, is that we've established that, I mean, there truly be an independent relationship there when you license out. Have these licenses.
Follow, Madam Chair?
Follow.
I'm just a little confused because that's all I've heard so far in the discussion of the bill is the employer-employee relationship. So that's why I'm getting the idea that that's what this is all about, and the rest of it really isn't the real crux of what you want here today.
I guess I'll one of my reasons for being here this morning is to introduce you to our lawsuit, which I think is an important, you know, it's not the overriding goal of this legislation, but it's an important thing to understand that you know, the OLCC is a very expensive proposition for the state. It's and we've got a tight budget right now, and I think the cost of maintaining, I mean, the way these individual liquor agents should be treated is as employees, because that is the nature of their relationship.
One last follow, Madam Chair.
We are going to be on a tight
okay.
schedule, so go ahead and Representative Shoffer.
Did you say it?
Go ahead, and then Representative Shoffer, and then we'll go on.
Would passage of this legislation affect your lawsuit?
It pretty much moot the lawsuit, yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, how many agents are there, and from among them, how many want to disband, get rid of, close down OLCC?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, there are a total of 240 agents, and as time has gone on over these past few years, the number of agents that are either unhappy with the current system or are financially not able to keep up the standard that OLCC requires for shrinking budgets has been increasing over the years. We do have an association, but I don't believe they are taking an official stand at this. But what might help you understand the frustration of the agents best is the way the system is set up. We are subject to market fluctuations, market prices on everything, the labor, social costs, the rent, insurance, taxes, everything goes up, as you know. And then through the budget system that OLCC is required to follow, our income is regulated by the budget. And we haven't had a budget increase in commission for the last three sessions. Matter of fact, about 2 weeks ago, they took $452,000 out of the budget to help pay for the shortcomings. And this cannot continue. We have two agents that I personally know of that are close to bankruptcy. They are signed on long-term leases. They pay as much as $40 a square foot of rent a year. They need, according to OLCC, a minimum of 2,000 square feet, and they have daily sales of $800 to $1,000, and the OLCC pays them 7 to 8% commission on that. You just cannot make ends meet, and this system is going to crash if it does not get changed.
Mr. Grable, can you tell us how many states have gone to privatization? Do you know out of the 50?
Out of the 50 states, Madam Chair, we have 18 control states, and starting about 9-10 years ago, I believe Iowa was the first one that changed their system. They still call themselves a control state. They control the revenue and use liquor as a major source of income, but they privatized the retail system, the enforcement system, went to other agencies, they privatized the wholesale operation, and most of these changes took place over several legislative sessions. They weren't accomplished all at once. But today, we have more than half out of those 18 with the private retail system and other changes have taken place too.
Can you tell me too, there's a blank in the bill for the privilege tax on distilled liquor. Do you know nationwide what those taxes tend to be?
Madam Chair, I don't know figures like that in the exact amount, but I believe Alabama is the highest state in liquor revenue generated. Washington is the second highest, and Oregon is in third place.
Okay. Thank you.
And our current markup is about 108%. So if a $10 bottle enters the warehouse, it gets 108% markup and gets shipped to the retail store.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grapel, under Section 4 of the bill, it says that the newly created agents will be able to buy the state's liquor stock based on the price per bottle paid by the Commission plus the markup amount imposed by law in effect before the operative date, that is the amount of markup that exists now. This bill also assumes that there will be a savings of $20 million to the state by the sale of the liquor inventory. But I don't understand why a newly established independent agent would buy from the state at the marked-up price rather than buying from a wholesaler at the wholesale price. And unless that can be explained, I don't see how the state sells its inventory under this law.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I agree with what you just explained there. Several of us have looked at this bill, and there are certain problems with it, but I think they are mainly due to the fact that none of the people that are involved in this industry had a hand in crafting this, and it will need some changes, and it needs some work to be done.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Could you tell us what the other problems are with the bill that need to be fixed that you're aware of?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I don't have the bill in front of me at this point, but I have spent some time looking it over, and there are several sections that would need to be changed. Most of all, there seems to be a confusion in some parts of the bill, especially the one you just mentioned, where agents would buy at the markup. Well, they wouldn't be agents any longer. They would be independent contractors. They would have a license, and if a wholesale license would be established as their bill foresees, then they would, of course, buy through the wholesaler and at an established price that the legislator would probably determine how much of a tax rate there should be on there. But I agree with you that agents would not be able to purchase the existing inventory at the current markup as we do now, and then the retail price still being determined by the state and us making the same 8.5% as we're doing now. We can't do it now. We can't add expense to it and then try to do it. So I agree with you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We're going to bring up Karen Gregory of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And I'd also like Bill George and Judy Cushing to come with her. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Karen Gregory. I'm the interim director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you about House Bill 3130. I have given you written testimony, so I will just take a few brief minutes to point out the really salient points in the testimony. The OLCC opposes House Bill 3130. This bill would dramatically change the way distilled spirits are distributed and controlled in Oregon, and we believe that these changes would actually do more harm than good. To give you an idea of the impacts of the revenue part of House Bill 3130, the OLCC is a revenue-producing agency. And House Bill 3130 would significantly alter the revenue stream for the Liquor Commission. In the first biennium, 03-05, this bill would go into effect at the midpoint. At that point, the revenue generation would decline by nearly $71 million. In the second biennium of this bill, which is 05-07, the decline would be $145 million. And that takes into effect the new distilled spirits tax that is detailed in the bill. So there is a huge drop here in revenue. And while House Bill 3130 has this tax in the bill, that is designed to continue the revenue flow to the general fund. The loss of revenue to cities and counties is quite significant in this bill. And finally, we have a major public policy issue, and that has to do with our research telling us that when states move to privatization, there is an increase in alcohol consumption. When there's an increase in alcohol consumption, you typically see a corresponding increase in public safety and health costs. And that results in an increase in overservice of alcohol, more minors obtaining alcohol, and an increase in problems associated with neighborhood livability and public safety. Oregonians are very concerned about alcohol issues. They're very concerned about impaired driving, about minors being able to access alcohol, and about violent crime. And an effective state system such as Oregon helps to limit the costly physical and social damages caused by the misuse of alcohol. Your communities, your neighbors, your families, and your friends could be hit hard in a very negative way if this bill were to pass. So we are strongly urge you not to move forward on this bill. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll do the whole panel before we go to questions, so go ahead.
Okay, my name is William George, and I'm currently an agent at State in Oregon. I've been an agent for approximately five years. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous here.
Take your time.
I've never done this before, so I'm new at it. To start with, I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. I've been an agent for about 5 years now. I have three employees, and sometimes four when we're really in the busy season. And I just completed last year building a brand new building exclusively to sell liquor at a cost of about $350,000, which I'm currently financing. I pay for it myself. I think what's happening in a lot of this, and a lot of people don't realize and really haven't seen the big picture on the thing. Karen talks about the cost to the state on losing the state revenue on taxes. Well, it can be even a bigger picture than that. If I have to compete with Circle K, Safeway, Fred Meyer, AMPM, and all those places, I can't. When they put liquor in their stores, they're not going to hire new employees. They're going to keep the same basic structure they have. It's like if I put a new product line in my store, I don't hire new employees. I just put the new product line in. So consequently, what happens is that in the process of this, the agents that do have to compete against the Safeway, the Circle K's, AMPMs, if it comes down to that, I don't know that it will, are going to end up getting rid of all those employees. So it's not just the 240 liquor agents. It's also the 240 plus their employees that can go down the drain. The only possible benefit I could see coming from this is that if it is privatized, that possibly my license would be worth a lot to sell to somebody like Safeway or something like that. It would be for a short-term employee that was not going to stay at the state for a long period of time, it could be a tremendous benefit to that person. Myself, I plan on doing it, and I said the system works pretty good, and I'm happy with it, and I think a lot of other agents, I can't speak for them. If it's not broke, you know, why fix it? And also, let's see, I think the same answer again. One of the questions that was brought up earlier was about the liquor sales, and I guess as far as the possibility of them going up or down, I do believe that if they are in every store, every AMPM or Circle K or anything else like that,
I do believe liquor sales would go up. I don't know that that's a good thing. It's just like we were talking about the other day. A person comes into my store and wants to buy a pack of cigarettes. I can't sell it to him unless he's 21 years old. He can't even buy them, even though it's legal, he can buy them at 18. But when he comes into my store, he can't buy them unless he's 21. You go into AMPM and you've got a pint sitting there on the counter. Now, granted, you're not supposed to sell it to him if he's 21 years old, but it's awful easy to slide it in the pocket. They can't even come to my store unless they're with their adult or guardian. And that's really all I have to say, sorry.
That's a good point. Thank you. We appreciate the agents coming because you're the ones that deal with us every day, so we appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Judy.
Good morning. My name is Judy Cushing, and I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Partnership, a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to substance abuse prevention and treatment referral. I also currently sit on the panel for the National Academy of Sciences that has been tasked by Congress to study the public policies, laws, and strategies that are impacting underage drinking in America. I want to thank you, committee members and committee chair Close, for taking testimony today on this important question about whether to privatize the sale of distilled spirits in Oregon. We believe it is important that liquor sales continue to be regulated by the OLCC in order to promote moderation and help offset the massive social and economic costs of alcohol use and preserve an efficient system that generates much-needed revenue for public programs here in Oregon and enhances the livability. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission is constitutionally required to promote moderation in recognition of the harms that alcohol causes, and the agency is very effective in that role. Consumption of distilled spirits in controlled states such as Oregon, on an average, are 15% lower per capita compared with non-control states, according to the NIAAA, the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse. It's an important force for moderation, which would be lost if responsibility for alcohol regulation were delegated to private industry.
Judy, we're not going to be able to read the whole testimony. Could you summarize the main point?
Yes. During the past couple of decades, it's been very, very evident that alcohol monopolies really allow alcohol consumption to go up, and we absolutely have to do everything at this point to discourage increase in alcohol consumption, particularly among our underage population. In Oregon at this time, 1/4 of our 8th graders are consuming alcohol. That's 1 in 4 8th grade students, and the average age of first use is going down. When alcohol is more available to young people in grocery stores or local neighborhood stores, we know that underage consumption will go up. The state plays a very significant role in reducing and controlling underage use here, and the OLCC plays a role in their compliance checks where underage volunteers go into the stores, and in also the beverage sales training program that the liquor agents go through, and also the other actually public sales of beer, etc., the grocers, retailers, etc., go through. They qualify their licensees, they do compliance checks, checking for IDs, etc. It's extremely important and an important part of the prevention activities concerning underage drinking. In the next year, the OLCC looks to conduct 1,000 compliance checks statewide, and there'll be 200 new licensees that will have responsible vendor program. They also are an important resource for Oregon in terms of our revenue, and we know that alcohol costs our taxpayers about $900 million a year. We've got to find the revenue to address those costs, the economic costs to all of the taxpayers in Oregon. Currently, the OLCC will generate a revenue of about $104 million. $54 million goes into the state general fund. We simply must not do away with the very entity that's helping us control underage drinking and bringing revenue into our state and making our state more livable.
Okay. Thank you very much. In the interest of taking the testimony of the people that have come from Portland, we're going to move on. So I appreciate the panel. I would like to call Karen back up for questions at the end, if you can stay. Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to call Ed Winters, Multnomah, Eric Winters, Richard Burke, who is the Libertarian Party of Oregon, and Frank Sigler of Lane County. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Winters. I'm here representing Oregon Free Spirits Coalition. I'm a chief petitioner on a ballot measure that would seek to privatize the OLCC. Don McIntyre and I filed this petition first for the 2002 cycle. I had a lot of support, but didn't quite make it. And we're gearing up to do it in the 2004 cycle. However, you could relieve us of a lot of legwork in the next year and a half if with a little fine-tuning, you helped pass House Bill 3130. And by the way, Don McIntyre could not be here today, but he does send his regards. The Oregon liquor monopoly has been around since Prohibition ended, and the primary justification, or at least one of them at the time, was that we had to reduce the influence of gangsters. Now, that notion sort of seems preposterous nowadays, that Al Capone might be running liquor sales in Oregon. But that was a fear that was real back in the 30s. If we were to start over from scratch right now, I seriously doubt that Oregonians would form anything that remotely resembles the current state liquor monopoly. Unfortunately, over the last 70 years, a number of interests have become heavily invested in this status quo. And to effectively privatize the OLCC, you'll have to do some heavy grappling with these interests. I wasn't aware of all of them when I first got into this. For the record, I don't have any interest in the liquor industry. I don't own a bar. I'm an attorney. The only monetary interest I might have is a better price on a single malt scotch. But other than that, I'm here politically solely for political reasons. I think that the government shouldn't be in this business, and it would be a great way to send a message to the voters of the state that the government is able to reform itself when the need presents itself. I'd like to sketch for you what I've termed the OLCC privatization players. There are people on both sides of the issue, and if you do have the courage and the wherewithal to push this forward, there'll be people popping up all over. Many of them will be testifying here today. Some will be saying this cannot be done. Some will be saying it can be done. Some will be waiting to see the form in which it takes. And over the last 2 years, I've been taking notes on all of these players, and I'd like to share some of them with you. First off,
we do have a time constraint, so okay. If you could do it quickly.
I will try to run through it very, very quickly. First off, the restaurant and bar owners. As was mentioned earlier, we have the third highest government added price markup in the country. If designed properly, privatization will lead to competition, which may lower wholesale prices. And the bar owners would love this. The OLCC has a terrible reputation among the bar owners, and I found that I had over 100 bar owners voluntarily collect 20,000 signatures for me in the course of 2 months in the last signature drive cycle. I think this number will probably double in this cycle. The grocers are very interested, obviously, in gathering a share of this market, and I think that the creation of private liquor licensing will open the door for grocery interests to eventually enter the market. And with proper precautions in place, we can shield minor access, and we can phase in competition so that liquor agents aren't harmed by the sudden force to adapt. And you'll find that there are a number of liquor stores. Most of the liquor stores who are in favor of privatization are metro area liquor stores or liquor stores on the borders of the state. The majority of liquor agents do resent the OLCC. However, many are very paralyzed by the fear of the agency or fear of competition if the free market is allowed to flow in too quickly. But most of them believe, at least the ones that I have talked to, that if they're given a fair chance to compete, if a system is phased in, they can compete with the grocery stores by offering specialty selection and additional service, just as long as they have enough time to adapt.
And, I'm going to give you 30 seconds more and we're going on.
Well, I have, unfortunately, way more than 30 seconds left, but I would like to at least close by saying that you're facing a political minefield. And if you can navigate it, if you keep track of two objectives. First, the government shouldn't be in the business of peddling booze to its citizens. And it's possible to get the government out of this business without threatening state revenues. Some of the interests, which I did not have an opportunity to name, will be rather disturbed by the process along the way. But if you keep those goals in mind, I think you can serve the customers and voters of this state a lot better. You can create additional private sector jobs. And you will restore, I think, in many ways, the faith of the voters who believe that this government is incapable of reforming itself in any way other than through the initiative process.
Thank you very much. Go to Richard Burke, Libertarian Party.
Okay, thank you very much. For the record, I am Richard Burke, Executive Director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it'll just take a couple of minutes here.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm looking at this document from the League of Oregon Cities, and I looked at some of the names on it, and I know and respect a lot of these people. But there are three objectives: promoting public safety, creating partnerships in livable neighborhoods, and revenue sharing. You know, these are all goals that are not unique to the Liquor Commission. A lot of states use a lot of different ways to control liquor, and I don't think any of those states that have different methods oppose promoting public safety or oppose creating partnerships for livable neighborhoods or oppose revenue sharing. And the fact is that the OLCC is a relic, and I think a lot of people know it, even a lot of the OLCC supporters. I refuse to believe that Oregonians and their governmental entities are less intelligent or less capable than those of other states who have successfully established more efficient means of enforcing liquor safety laws and distributing alcohol in a efficient manner. The OLCC's objectives itself represent an inherent conflict of interest. Take a look at what they're supposed to be doing: temperance and revenue enhancement. I was listening to Karen Gregory get up here and make contentions about how much money would be lost if we got the OLCC out of this business. Well, wait a minute. Why is that of interest to her? She is supposed to be promoting temperance. You see the inherent contradiction in that there is, an inherent interest. And the reason for this is that government has never been able to successfully promote temperance over time of any product that was highly in demand. This is a fundamental reason why prohibition itself was repealed. Temperance is an important thing, but it's a mission that properly exists in our communities, in our churches, our relief societies, our service clubs, and our families. And if we are to expend resources promoting temperance, I would suggest to you that helping these institutions would be much more useful than helping a dysfunctional organization like the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Let's talk about the dysfunction. A lot of times, when organizations try to justify its existence, it tries to expand the scope of its mission. And the OLCC has done this by, in effect, becoming a self-anointed morality commission. Some examples. I have some documentation here. There's a controversial club, Stars Cabaret. It's an exotic dance club. And I'm not endorsing the activities that take place there, but there are some important things that happened. On February 28th at 10 o'clock, an OLCC agent, a pair of them, came to check out liquor server permits. And one of them was quoted to say, with three witnesses present, that the OLCC is at war with the owners and managers of Stars, so I advise you not to get in the middle of it. I have a lot of documentation, and there are people who I can give you to provide you direct testimony that don't want to be their names disclosed in public because of fear of retribution. But if you are open to this, I can arrange meetings with people who have witnessed situations like this in the future.
Let me ask you specifically, yeah. If the OLCC, if it went to privatization, how would it affect places like Stars?
Well, I think what would happen is what remains of the Liquor Control Commission would be concerned with its proper mission, and that is whether or not minors are getting alcohol and whether or not people are leaving in an intoxicated state hitting the roads, just as it would be the case with any conventional bar. I would contend that is the community's business as to the kind of entertainment provided. It's not the Oregon Entertainment Control Commission, it's the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Another example, there is a bar that plays a lot of rap music, and the manager was told they should play less rap music because it attracts the wrong clientele. Okay. Then going back to Stars, there was a bus. They have a bus that they bring events to, and the windows are blocked. And the OLCC charged that there was lewd activity taking place on the bus because of the tinted glass, not because anything had been witnessed. So how do you appeal this? You can't. And what does this have to do with making sure minors don't get booze? What does this have to do with making sure that people aren't driving on the road? You know, what's happening is enforcement of these rules is arbitrary and targeted. And that is not what's supposed to happen in a country like the United States, where everyone is supposed to have the laws applied to them equally and where they're supposed to be consistently enforced, and they should be sticking with the mission. So we contend that not only has... The reason why I bring this up...
Well, let me just interrupt for a minute. Yeah. Committee, we are at the end of our meeting. I intend to stay and take the rest of the testimony, and you're welcome to stay. Pretty much what is left is our people who are in the lobby, Paul Romaine, Mary Bodkin, and Jason Williams. So, and we do have two more citizens left, so we will go until 11, and we respect your schedule that you've already made.
And I'll just close. I'm going to say that the OLCC was created out of prohibition, and it is just as obsolete and dysfunctional now as the Federal Rural Electrification Board. It's something that was set up in the Depression, should have been abolished long ago. So should the OLCC. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I think the Libertarian Party has been true to their platform today. And we will go to Frank Siegler.
My name is Frank Siegler. I'm the founder of the Oregon Wine Market. It was a company set up to provide marketing services for the small and medium-sized Oregon wineries to find them new markets. We found 8 million wine enthusiasts who had never heard of Oregon wine before. During the 2 years that we worked with the OLCC to try to work with them, just to work with them, we were subjected to harassments and threats for licensing that they kept trying to force fit us. We didn't sell the wine, we didn't warehouse it, we didn't even touch it, we didn't ship it, nothing. We were a marketing services firm, just like an advertising agency. We put up with that for 2 years. The latest is they began to threaten our clients, the Oregon wineries, with the loss of their license if they did business with us. At that point, I said, the hell with it. I'm moving to another state. This was the second entrepreneurial situation that I had in Oregon. The last one got funded by Intel Corporation, moved to San Jose, mainly because of some of the bureaucratic problems in the state of Oregon. But when I ran into the OLCC and the way they operate, where they make a ruling, and that's it, you have no recourse. Their answer is, well, hire a lawyer. Well, fine. You hire a lawyer, used to fighting with the OLCC, guess what? They've got other clients that have licenses issued by the OLCC. So what are you going to do? You're going to kowtow to the OLCC because they hold the trump card. There is no recourse. There's no arbitration. This is a group that is appointed by the governor. These six directors pick the one person, and they literally have run roughshod over the Oregon wine industry. The Oregon wine industry is caught in a crossfire among the big boys. You've got the liquor distributors, and you've got, you know, the fight that's going on. Well, the collateral damage being done to the Oregon wine industry, I mean, these are farmers in the best sense of the word. These are
people that are into the art and science of wine. And I have never run across wine as good as is made in Oregon. It's because of the diligence of the Oregon wineries. And yet, they are under the thumb of the OLCC. Why not put them back into the Department of Agriculture where they belong? That's basically, well, the reason I wanted to come today was say, I enjoyed my 5 years in Oregon.
And you live where now?
Pardon?
You live where now?
I still didn't hear you.
Where do you live now?
The house is for sale.
I see.
Oh, and by the way, you asked about some of the other states that had things like the OLCC and what was their experience. You might want to check into North Carolina. Just a few years ago, they did away with their liquor board, and it was amazing the savings that they wound up with after they did.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Very interesting, very fascinating. I'm going to call Thomas Matthews and Mark Carson, and thank you for being so patient, Wayne. I know you've been sitting a long time.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mark Carson, and I have the liquor store that is in the picture in the handout that I gave you. OLCC is as outdated as the store in this picture, which has a special meaning to me personally. It was taken the year I was born, and my father is the second person on the left. Store 2 was opened February 16th. 1934, and was the first liquor store opened in the state of Oregon. Yesterday is gone, as should the archaic Oregon Liquor Control Commission. They have just outlived their usefulness. Others will talk of the many faults of the OLCC. My support for House Bill 3130 is based on one simple question: what good do they do? This is truly a difficult question for them from all perspectives, especially when you consider the answer is no to all of the following questions. Do they arrest people for drunk driving? Do they control bootlegging in Oregon? Are they honest with the legislators in the budget process? Do they negotiate to protect Oregon from litigation? Do they have expertise in areas that will help enhance Oregon's liquor industry? Have they established and maintained a positive public image? Are they cost-effective? Is their rulemaking fair, responsible, and efficient? With all the problems OLC faces through litigation and initiative petitions, is effective management demonstrated? Are the best interests of Oregon being met by the OLCC? Is this a complete list of failures? My first job title 34 years ago was a liquor store clerk. Since that time, it has been my privilege to observe the good and the bad associated with the OLCC. From firsthand experience, let me tell you that things have gone downhill, and it is time for a complete change in Oregon's alcoholic management philosophy. OLCC has become nothing more than a fundraising organization with the facade of managing alcohol in Oregon. Careful scrutiny of OLCC's actions will clearly demonstrate management's willingness to go to almost any means to keep personal power. Recently, budget cuts were mandated. The fat cat survived and allowed the lower level workers to pay the bill. This produced the interesting situation of a stores director only supervising three professional district representatives and a part-time secretary. Government waste at its finest. OLCC just sent out a memorandum to all liquor stores stating that they'll no longer provide current year's driver's license guide to the stores because of budget constraints. One must question the judgment of an organization that keeps expensive bureaucrats in lieu of the needed useful work tools. I view House Bill 3130 as a fine starting point towards the redistribution of OLCC's power. The Oregon Department of Revenue should handle the money. Let's give the enforcement positions and automobiles to the state police, where real alcohol management occurs. Licensing retail liquor sales makes perfect sense. Several state agencies would be appropriate to manage the liquor licensing functions. Last Tuesday morning, I watched my attorney, Mr. David Nipon, argue before the Oregon Court of Appeals. The issues being litigated are simple. OLCC needs to license me, make me a state employee, or make me a truly independent contractor by removing their employee-type regulations. The OLCC's attorney noted that you folks in the legislature have bills before you that will eliminate the OLCC, making court action moot. Actually, he was wrong. The court action will make a decision, and that decision will have an effect. Sadly, OLCC could have easily avoided this entire mess had they been willing to negotiate. Liquor store operators made many attempts to work with the OLCC to find a reasonable solution to the problems. They and their representatives were rebuffed each time. I would love to spend the day sharing interesting stories that illustrate the need for the OLCC to disappear. However, it is time to respond to any questions you may have, and thank all of you for the time.
Thank you, and we do not have time for questions. Mr. Matthews, if you could give your testimony in 1 minute and not read it, I'd appreciate it.
I plan to.
Okay.
Because I'm in a hurry, too. I took this day off. I delayed my vacation one day so I could visit with you folks.
Thank you for being here.
Honestly, I'd like to respond to Representative Murphy's question on the price. That price will be determined by the tax, which is blank line in the bill at this time, and there is a cost of operation added to the top of it. There are only four components in the price of the liquor: the cost of the physical plant, the cost of employees, the cost of profit, and the cost of any taxes that the legislature imposes. That combination will determine the bill price, no matter what the tax is.
Clarification, Madam Chair.
Clarification.
Are you addressing the price at which the state would sell its surplus liquor to the new retailers?
No, you asked the question, what would the new price be? Will there be any savings?
No, that wasn't my question.
Oh, okay. I'm
yeah.
Sorry. You want to rephrase it?
Liquor, I offered some suggestions to Representative Miller's people to address that issue because it's one that needs to be cleared up.
Oh, let's go ahead with
that. A couple other things that have been given a testimony here. I find it interesting that a leader of an agency would quote to a loss of $71 million and $140 million when they don't even know what the tax levels are going to be. That's nothing but a scare tactic. You people should run for cover in the bomb shelter. Then I see a consumption figure here that we're 15% lower than everybody else. But it's been noted in other testimony that we don't enforce the borders in Oregon. Our prices are very, very high, and there's just a river of alcohol coming across the southern border. We don't drink less in Oregon. In fact, some of our people are pretty good drinkers. We just buy at other places. We don't get the benefits from the taxes. And the last comment that I thought was interesting is a fourth of our age graders are drinking. That certainly speaks not very well for the enforcement of the liquor and prevention of minors getting to alcohol by our existing agency. I think we need a change. And with that, I will close my testimony if anyone has a question. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your colorful testimony, Paige.
Well, the dinosaur, he started years ago when he wrote a better government. You can type on the SB Policy Institute website, type Tiny Matthews in there, and it would give you the whole thing.
I see.
But he was a logo. and everybody wants to take a bite out of these poor green hides.
I see.
And, you know, you're going to see everybody say, hey, don't take my piece of the dinosaur. But really, you folks need the courage to just go out and ask some of your constituents. Take a poll amongst your constituents. Not the people that are in here talking to you, because they're going to say what they want you to do. Go out and talk to some of the people and see what they would do. And they're going to tell you, we want a better government, we want to get rid of these people. Because they have a reputation with the public that is not as bad as you get. Probably the worst state agency in the business for reputation with the public. That's not positive. So, anyway, that's why the dinosaur is existing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Matthews, and we appreciate you coming and your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to call our lobby. Saved you for last because you're here every day. I hope you understand. Paul Romaine, Mary Bodkin, Jason Williams.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I'm going to give you just a little bit of background. I used to be the Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Oregon from 1977 to 78, at which time I also served in the role of Special Counsel for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We went through an investigation of the commission at that time. I've been associated with or dealt with the commission for probably longer than most anybody in the state of Oregon. I've seen it go through many changes. I can tell you that it's one heck of a good organization compared to what it used to be. It does provide good service. And I just wanted to hit a couple of points. Number one, availability of product in the state. You get far greater availability of different products in a control state than you do in an open state. Oregon is a control state. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission will order for you any product that you want as long as it's sold in the United States. All you have to do is agree to pay for one case of that product. They will bring it in from wherever it is. It will not cost you any more than buying anything else off their shelf. That's number one. Number two, the cost of the product is determined by the amount of tax you take. The reason that people end up having liquor shipped in from California or Maryland, which has a very low tax, or some other state, is because those states have chosen to tax the product less than we do. We have the third highest tax, if you would. That's why the product is high. If you privatize the liquor industry, my people will be the wholesalers. We cannot wholesale as cheaply as the state wholesales. The reason for that is very simple. What the state does is they purchase it, they go to a manufacturer, and the manufacturer comes to them. The manufacturer is told, we want it shipped to the state of Oregon. We'll buy it at the cheapest price. You ship it to us. We're the only buyer. You ship it at your expense. You store it in our warehouse in Milwaukee at your expense, and we won't even pay for it until we put it out in the Green Front store. You can imagine a beer distributor trying to do that with Anheuser-Busch. It would be a former beer distributor the next day. It doesn't work that way. There's a huge savings. Our cost of wholesaling a product is about 20% of sales. The OLCC cost of wholesaling is less than 2% of sales. That goes into the price. So if you simply take the same amount of money the state wants to keep the same amount of money and leave everything the same, when you privatize, you will increase the cost to the consumer considerably. So we can't do it as cheaply. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm going to be very brief. We represent about 200 families who depend on the OLCC for their livelihood. And we also like to think that we represent a lot of Oregonians that depend on the OLCC to enforce liquor laws and control the sale of liquor, distilled spirits only, of course. Our goal as an agency and as employees who work for that agency is to make liquor available to responsible consumers for responsible consumption. We provide great customer service. If this bill were to pass, most of rural Oregon's liquor stores would immediately go out of business because they would be forced to buy the inventory for which they have no ability to buy. The other thing that they would be forced to do is they would be forced, if they could stay in business after they had to buy their own inventory, they would have to then move to a situation where they have to buy full cases of liquor rather than buying broken cases. In other words, they can special order high-end liquors that they don't move as quickly or liquors that they move quicker than others and break a case, and we will special package those cases for them based on their order and the consumption of their consumers in their areas. This whole idea of privatizing OLCC, let me just say that this is the only time you're ever going to hear me say that we should continue privatizing what's already been privatized. We privatized OLCC 2 decades ago. We moved it from completely state-owned and operated to individuals owning their own stores, running their own operations. Yes, they have controls. Madam Chair, they're not selling eggs. They're not selling lettuce. They're selling liquor. Liquor makes people crazy sometimes. It kills our kids. It kills our moms. You know, when we ran, when Eric Winters and those folks ran their ballot measure, we sat down with the liquor agents and worked out a coalition program with Mad Mothers. It was the union Mad Mothers and the liquor agents put together a decline to sign campaign. When we printed up the literature and made it available to the liquor agents, there were 10 agents in the state of Oregon who did not take literature to hand out at their liquor stores. The reason they didn't get on the ballot, Madam Chair, is because there's virtually no support. The liquor agents that we work with like the way the system works. We have a good system. It's efficiently run. The employees work hard. They do more with less. There's very little complaining. And if you go down to the budget committee, you'll hear them talk about the cutbacks that they've had. Population's up. Sales are up. This is an agency that makes us a lot of money. We need the money. And you know what? We need the enforcement and everything else as well. If they want to compete with Liquor Bar and tell them to move to California, I will take any one of those stores. You know, they have not offered one to me over all these years, but I'll take any one of those stores that these guys don't want anymore, and I'll run it, or I'll have my husband run it, because you know what? They make money.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. And the last word goes to Jason.
Thank you very much. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, the Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. And gave you a little handout talking about how some of the problems of OLCC is being picked up by editorial boards around the state. Hillsborough complains, you know, here they are, the second biggest county, and they've only got 16 liquor stores, and they're having problems getting new ones. And same thing there with Bend area. The Ben Bolton saying, you know, 27 years between the last liquor store being built. So you're seeing that there is this kind of momentum out there, and I would say that being involved with some of the initiative gathering on this the first time around is that when we asked people to go out and collect for several of our signatures, different petitions that we had, that the OLCC was one of the more popular ones. So, yeah, I definitely think it resonates with the public, the idea about getting rid of something that's just unnecessary. And I think taxpayers lose twice. First of all, because we are paying for employees in a structure that just is unnecessary. It doesn't need to exist. Other states have shown it doesn't need to exist. So we're paying taxpayer money for that. Second of all, when people do go across the border, I mean, they're just amazed at how good deals that they can get under a system where, you know, it's open up to the free market. And so they buy some of their liquor purchases out of state and bring them here. So we're losing money unnecessarily with that. So there was just two ways we're losing revenue unnecessarily. And so when you think about it, if we have the system that it doesn't need to be there, that it doesn't work, that has all of these problems, and you've heard it today, we need to reach the point where we need to modernize. We can become like other states and fix this, which we feel is just philosophically wrong. There does not need to be this over-regulation of something that's for an adult product. And we feel like, you know, this idea about price and availability, well, we can not have the teens get it if we just raise the price. I hate going down that path because, you know, why don't we just raise the price of rated R movies? Why don't we raise the price of driving? And that will keep underage people away from that. And I feel like that is just not necessarily the key function of government, is to raise the price of something just to keep adults or the people who shouldn't be using the project from purchasing it. But please do take a look at the what some of the editorials have said around the state, and I think that would give you a good education on the issue.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, committee, for bearing with us and everybody who came. This does have a referral to revenue where the discussion would continue, so we will intend to work the bill some more. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.